If you were red tonight, remember what I said tonight. For red is the color that my baby wore, and what's more is true. Yes, it is. Scarlet were the clothes she wore. Everybody knows, I'm sure. I would remember all the things we planned. Understand, it's true. Yes, it is, it's true. Yes, it is. I could be happy with you by my side.
Hello again and welcome to I've Got a Beatles Podcast. And it's Dave coming at you with another interview today. And I am pleased to welcome back to the program Beatles expert, John Lennon expert, author of 3 and soon to be 4 books on John Lennon, Jude Sutherland Kessler. So great to have you back, Jude.
Dave, thank you so very much for having me. When John Lennon's birthday was approaching, and I talked to my agent, Nicole Michael, at 910PR, she asked me, what would you like to do for John Lennon's birthday? And I said, well, if I could have my choice of any show to be on, I want to be on I've Got a Beatles Podcast.
Oh,
for Dave.
Thank you.
And she said, well, let me see if I can make that happen. So this is exactly what I wanted to do to celebrate John's birthday.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, thank you for thinking of us here. This is terrific. And that's actually a really great way to get things started here. We'll come back to Yes, It Is in a moment. But as you said, John Lennon, we're recording today on October 10th, and he would have turned 77 yesterday. So thinking back, what do you think John's legacy is in 2017? Kind of with you're immersed in his work and immersed in his story. What do you think he means to the world and music and everything else now?
You know, I've been going around the country doing a Beatles Stones debate with author Lena Stagg, who does the Recipe Records series. She is taking the Stones side, and I, of course, am taking the Beatles side. Of course.
Yes.
And it never have I been more aware of what the Beatles contributed. And since it's John's idea, since he handpicks the members of the band, and then during all those occasions when they wanted to quit, when Paul went back to school, back to the Liverpool Institute to get his teaching degree, and George got a job as an electrician's mate, and Pete went back to playing with various bands around Liverpool, and John had to go and round them up and say, what are you doing? What's wrong with you? Why are you wasting your time with this penny ante stuff? Because we're going to be bigger than Elvis. You just have to believe in the plan. You got to stick to the plan. We're going to the toppermost of the poppermost. So when you look at that perspective, really the influence of the Beatles really begins with the dream and the determination and persistence of John Lennon. So what is the scope of that outreach? Well, everything.
Yes.
He changed the way we hear music. Songs are no longer just 2 minutes on the radio. They don't obey any rules. Bands don't record just during the daytime and at 5 o'clock they close shop. They record whenever they're productive and creative. Lyrics are on the back of albums. There are videos. Strawberry Fields was the first. Videos to go along with songs 11 years before MTV. There are groups who dress the way they want to dress and wear their hair the way they want to wear their hair. They are artists, not just pop singers or rock and rollers. They're artists. They express that art in the way their album covers are designed, in the way they carry themselves, and in the way they speak to the world. The Beatles changed our political view. All those girls who were screaming and running towards the stage found their voice in the Beatles. They found that they could be heard and that they could matter and make a difference, and they did make a difference. I mean, they bought the records. They propelled those boys to stardom. And so they really affect the feminist movement. Their insistence on not playing before segregated audiences, helps the civil rights movement along in a big way and makes a statement. They bring the Exciters along in the 1964 tour and Frogman Henry. They're very inclusive despite any color or creed or whatever. They include everyone. They change our styles, our clothes, even our glasses. There almost isn't a place that we can touch or see that the Beatles didn't change in just the short time they were together from August of 1962 to 1970. 8 years, they had a greater impact than the Rolling Stones have had in 55 years. So, it just, we laugh because Lena keeps saying, but the Stones had great longevity and, and you know, they've had 22 singles. I said, well, the Beatles had 18 singles, 17 of which went to number one in just 8 years. So I don't know the point there, you know. I mean, they are all pervasive. Every part of our lives they touched.
Yeah. And it's in a song like Yes It Is, which we started out with, really speaks to the point you made about art, about pop music becoming an actual art and the musicians taking the, paying a lot of attention to the arrangement, the vocals, the sounds, and just making it a real, real artwork. So what is it about Yes It Is in the lyrics or the music that, that you find particularly interesting?
Well, of course, I love those tight, beautiful harmonies.
Yes.
And they were such masters of that. When you go back and listen to songs like This Boy, they aren't really given credit early on for the fact that they are incredible singers and musicians. It is a maturity that you find in much more highly trained and developed musicians, and yet is inherent to their nature. You know, Liverpool had something to do with that. Coming out of that Irish culture where singing in families and singing in the streets and singing on the docks is part of what they grow up with every day. And then the sentimentality of Irish music, you definitely hear in Yes It Is. Mm-hmm. Red, scarlet was, of course, Julia's favorite color. And John is very plainly saying, I don't care who you are, if you wear red, that's who I'm going to think of. I'm going to remember all the things that we planned to do. And they had tons of plans. She was going to be at all of his shows. She was going to be there when he got his number one. She was going to be there when he left for America, when he conquered Elvis. I'll remember all the things we planned. Understand, it's true. Yes, it is. I mean, it's a heartbreaking song of loss.
Yeah.
And, you know, we just sing his little ditties as if they're little light and airy love songs, but from day one, long before meeting Bob Dylan, John Lennon is autobiographical. He's grabbing you by the arm, he's stopping you, and like the Ancient Mariner, he's telling you his story of woe, his personal story. And Yes It Is, it's one of the most heartbreaking.
And that's an interesting case because it goes again to the point of the Beatles being that a lot of their greatest songs weren't necessarily the hits, because that was a B-side, and yet all that's packed into that song in such a short amount of time, and the depth of emotional lyrics and the music, it's really pretty amazing. And it's just one of many, many gems on B-sides. Now, you have, as I said in the introduction, this is, you're writing your fourth book currently on John. You have volume one was called Should Have Been There, and then Shivering Inside, volume two, which is from 61 to 63-ish. Then the third book is She Loves You, and so we're right into Beatlemania. And now the current book you're working on, Should Have Known Better, takes us through around end of 64, is that correct?
Right. It's the entire year of 64. It was supposed to be 1964-65, but life is what happens while you're busy making other plans.
That's...
This book has been extremely difficult because I lost both of my parents during the writing of this book. And my mom died only 2 weeks into the writing of the book. And I inherited my dad, who at that time was about 94.
Wow.
And I had the care of him until he was 97. He passed away in March. And he was blind, 95% blind and about 90% deaf. So life was very complicated during those 3 years. And he needed a lot of care and attention. But that really brings home how difficult it is to live a life like the Beatles lived. They gave up all of their family associations to go out on the road and to work as hard as they did. I mean, John especially is leaving Cynthia behind when he goes on that North American tour in 1964. It takes her in February, but sees how dangerous that is. And when he takes off for the world tour in June, Mimi goes along only for part of the tour, and she's well escorted. But when he goes back to America on the 19th of August, 1964, he takes no one. It's going to be far too dangerous. And so he leaves her back at their brand new home, Kenwood, living in the servants' quarters up in the attic while that house is being renovated from a 27-room home to, and here's where the biographers disagree, either a 19-room home or a 16-room home. We don't know. But what we know is they were knocking down walls and making a huge transformation. She's left behind. His son is left behind. And all those family ties, the things that we let get into our lives and occupy our lives, you know, as well we should, the Beatles gave up. And for a long time, Maureen and Ringo don't get married. They put it off because he's so busy. Paul and Jane have that stormy relationship because both he and she are busy. She's an actress. She has a career that's taking her to all the corners of the globe. They, every single one of them, gives up so much in order to be dedicated to their dream and to their goal. And so, you know, at times when I'm too tired to write, it's 1 o'clock, I want to go to bed, I have to make myself say, what would the Beatles do? Mm-hmm. What would John do? He would go to that computer and he would work. And if you're too tired to create, you can at least edit or correct or whatever. And I try to stay on task to write every night until at least 4 a.m. Wow. And then sleep for a few hours and get up and go again.
Well, part of the reason that your books take a long time is because you actually document everything. And so you have to put all those citations down. And especially for a year like 1964 that was so important in the Beatles' career, with all these huge highs going on with playing Ed Sullivan, the Hard Day's Night, all the touring, everything happening. It must be just incredible to have to go through so many sources and sift out what's true and what's not. So what have you found in writing this book that maybe is different from the previous books, or has it all been kind of similar, like grinding it out kind of work sometimes?
One thing that remains consistent throughout is the fact that the biographers disagree, and they disagree about everything.
Oh,
everything.
No.
I mean, you know, what time did the Beatles land at London Airport, some call it, or Heathrow, others call it, and some London Airport / Heathrow. So I had to go back and research what it was actually called. Or was Beatleland that area that was built for them outside of the airport when they go on their North American tour, was Beatleland built 1.2 miles from the airport, 500 feet from the airport, a mile from the airport? They can't agree on anything, and it's slow go to take each detail and look it up. About, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago, I can't remember, a really wonderful person, I hope we're going to say her name correctly now because it's spelled D-U-C-H-A-T-E-A-U. In Louisiana, that would be Ducato. But I think that she told me that it's pronounced Ducatow. And Susie Ducatow wrote to me and said, listen, I see what you're doing and know what you're doing, and I love to research mysteries. I would love to just help you solve some of the things you're solving. I was like, seriously? So things like, I would spend hours, Dave, taking the tapes of interviews that have not already been transcribed. Jay Spangler on BeatlesInterviews.org has done a tremendous job of transcribing many of the Beatles interviews. Dmitry Murashev, dmbeatles.com, has also done a good job. But sometimes the phrases that they've transcribed don't quite make sense. And I'm thinking, what does that mean? I'll give you an example in a second. I would spend hours and hours listening to those tapes and writing them line by line by line, 4 and 5 and 6 hours transcribing one tape. And so she has been so kind as to step in and help me with that. And that is really moving the process along. I owe her a great debt of gratitude. But let me tell you one example of how things can go wrong. In one of the North American interviews, and I believe it was Milwaukee, but I'm not 100% sure off the top of my head, a reporter says to Paul, how do you feel about George and Ringo being more popular than you are? And how do you feel about Ringo being more popular than you are? And John says, George goes a bomb in Sweden. It's translated in all of the transcriptions as George goes a bum, B-U-M, in Sweden. Well, that made no sense.
No, no.
What does he mean by that? George goes a bum.
A bum.
So we looked it up, and it's a bomb. George goes a bomb, B-O-M-B, in Sweden. And what that means in Liverpool vernacular in Scouse is to go a bomb is to be a big hit.
Hmm.
Oh, well, Dave Thurmeyer goes a bomb. He's a big hit, you know. That's what John is defending his little brother. He's defending George. And he's saying, look, in Sweden, the girls all love gorgeous George.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a minute detail. But that's the thing you've got to get right if you're going to make sense of what's being said in the interview. So imagine the time it takes just to sort that out. It is a very, very slow process. And thank goodness for Susie. Oh, my goodness.
Oh,
she's been
great.
Tremendous help.
I'm glad you've got some help. That's terrific. Because as you're alluding to, these are just such huge topics, and there's been so much written about them. And so I've always been interested in the stuff right after Ed Sullivan, kind of what happened after that period. So, you know, February 64, they make the big hit in America, and then eventually they go on a North American tour. But what kind of happens in between Ed Sullivan and then the summer, let's say?
So they return right before George's 21st birthday, and George is furious because he's been told they're not going to celebrate his birthday. They are slated to be in studio the first few days that they're back, working on the songs that they're going to release in their new upcoming United Artists film, which is yet unnamed. It's going to be a hard day's night.
Right.
And they have only a few days to record these songs because on the 2nd of March, they're going to start filming. And they don't return until the 23rd of February. So they are in studio 9 hours, 9 hours, 9 hours, 12 hours recording those songs. They have to get after it. And on George's 21st birthday, they're there before 10 o'clock in the morning, dressed in suits and ties, mind you. Ready to record. They've taken the coats off, but they have those ties on, mm-hmm. and they are ready to work all day long and record. And George is in a terrible mood because they're not going to do anything special. They do end up going out to dinner late that night, but that's about it.
Oh.
And then they start to work on the movie, and they are chagrined to find that they have to get up at 5:30 in the morning to have breakfast and get ready for the car to pick them up because they have to be on set. And this is one of those details I had to research to the hilt because everybody gives you a different time. They have to be on set by 7 a.m. to do hair and makeup.
And they used to hear complaints about the during the Let It Be filming, they used to complain about having to be there at 8 or 9, but this is worse.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, at 7 a.m. because they have to be ready at 8 to film, you know? And at lunchtime, when everybody else is taking a break, they're doing interviews. At 5 o'clock, when everybody else goes home, they go off to record TV shows and radio programs. They get home around 10 at night. That's fine if you can go to bed at 10. But John's producer and a helper from Jonathan Cape Publishers, who is working with him shoulder to shoulder and bringing in his own right to life, is waiting for him because they have to go through the manuscript, make sure it's okay. He's encouraging John to finish up the sketches. John works until at least midnight, 2 hours every night, grabs a bite to eat, and then goes to sleep and gets up again at 5:30 the next morning. So,
wow, brutal schedule.
It's a hair back from America Part 1 to America Part 2, the 180 hardest days of the Beatles' career includes a world tour a trip to Stockholm, lots, five Sunday concerts live in England, the taping of about 27 TV shows, ugh, radio shows, doing a Night of 100 Stars, the premiere, the London premiere of A Hard Day's Night, the Liverpool premiere. They never stop. They work, wow, Saturday and Sunday. It's grueling.
It is. Well, and you mentioned something that I think a lot of people forget about, but in his own right, that John was doing that as well. And what's your opinion? First, give us a little bit of background about how that book came to be, and then how do you think it holds up nowadays when people look at it? Is it the kind of book that you had to be there, or you had to really grow up in Liverpool, or do you think it's something that we can still find relevance and enjoy now?
Well, of course, Mimi had encouraged John from very early on not to waste time playing with toys or to waste time watching movies. Now, we know that he went to the movies because many of his drawings mimic Disney scenes. So Uncle George, as he called his Uncle George, would spirit him away to the picture drums in Liverpool. But Mimi felt that children should be productive. You could read, you could write, you could draw. And John spent a lot of time growing up drawing. By the time he gets to high school, he's doing that notebook called The Daily Howl, mm-hmm, caricatures of his professors. And he's beginning to write little ditties that go with them, sometimes just a funny caption, at other times poems. And he begins to carry scraps of paper with him in his pocket. And when he thinks of something funny or clever or an observation on humanity, he writes it on those slips of paper and he sticks it into his jacket. He used to wear his Uncle George's tweed jacket a lot. He'll stick it into his jacket pocket when he's finished writing. And he's covered in literature all of the time and in observations. So Bill Harry, his good friend at Liverpool College of Art, who becomes the editor for Mersey Beat, the first real music magazine, begins to encourage John, you know, give me some of those. Let me put these in Mersey Beat. And he does. And we're familiar with many of them, especially the dubious origins of the Beatles.
Oh, yeah. So,
you know, Partly Dave and all of those that were published in Mersey Beat. And people begin to read them. They're definitely Scouse-oriented. They have that biting wit with, mm-hmm, that dark-edged humor that is so popular in Liverpool. And the first time that I ever read them, as a very conservative young girl in Louisiana, I was like, oh my gosh, this is a poem about your dad on his birthday and you're standing by the door ready to kick him outside? What? You know? I was horrified.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the more you read them, the funnier they become. And you see John for who he is, a self-deprecating person who writes about himself more than he writes about anyone else. That insecure little boy for whom everyone should have been there and no one was is hiding in all that verse. So many of the poems are about his feeling of insignificance and all the people that he draws with claws and warts. Well, they're John Lennon. And it's a very revealing book. Now, you and I were talking a little bit before we went on air about the fact that John won the Foyles Literary Award for the book, the finest work of literature in all of England. That's the Foyles Literary Award. People that had won that award prior to him were Winston Churchill and Charlie Chaplin.
Oh, wow. Big names.
Yeah. Oh, it's huge. It's huge. And so all we knew for years was that when John got up to give the award, what he mumbles into the microphone is, "You've got a lucky face," and sits down. And that's it. So some people laughed and said, how clever, that's such a clever thing to say. Other people, even at the luncheon at the Dorchester Hotel, black tie, you know, elegant affair,
yeah,
booed him.
Ooh.
They booed him. And so I started investigating the story to see what happened. And so if we have time, I'll tell it real quickly.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, so the night before, he knows he's going to this luncheon. They invited him weeks ahead of time, and they invited him to give what they call the postprandial speech, the after-dinner speech. So John full well knows he's expected to give a speech. He at first says, yes, he'll do it. And Cynthia says, are you sure you're going to do this? And he says, oh, yes, absolutely, I'm doing it. But the closer it gets to the occasion, and he realizes that he's speaking to a room full of stars. I mean, Lionel Bart was seated next to him. All of the big names of the day are in the audience. Some he likes. I mean, Helen Shapiro is sitting there. Some of the people he really loves are sitting there. But the majority of the audience is made up of diamond matrons, well-known literary figures, well-known actors, and he's intimidated. He knows that the room is going to be exactly like that. So yeah. The day before, he calls Brian and he says, I can't do it. I can't give that speech. Can you give the speech for me? Huh. And Brian says, yes, I can do that. And John says, will you call the Dorchester and tell them that I'm not going to do it? And Brian says, yes. And he does call. He calls and says, John Lennon will not be giving the speech. I will be giving it on his behalf. Well, have you ever called a hotel desk and left a message for anyone?
It never gets there, right?
Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, whoever was on shift didn't relay it to the powers that be at the Foyles organization, and no one knows that John is not going to give that speech. Well, that night, the eve of this Foyles literary luncheon, John goes out with the other Beatles, some of the Rolling Stones, and some of his closest friends, and they party all night.
Of course.
4 a.m., they're picked up by his driver. They're taken to get an egg sandwich at a roadside place to eat, he and Cynthia, and they collapse in bed. Now, the rumor is that John goes the next day to film A Hard Day's Night. He does not. He is sound asleep. He is not in that shooting the next morning. Cynthia tells you in both of her books that they wake up and they realize it's after 10 o'clock and the luncheon is starting at 12. And the driver is coming to get them. So he's extremely nauseated, dizzy, still very drunk. So is she. And they stumble, holding onto the walls, and put their clothes on. And she says, are you sure that Brian is going to give the speech? He's like, yes, it's been taken care of. Quit bugging me. So they go off in their car to the luncheon. And when they get there and they're surrounded by flashbulbs and people shouting, and Mr. Lennon, what do you think? Do you deserve this award? And is it just because you're a Beatle? And he becomes more and more intimidated. Yeah, he's nauseated and doesn't wear his glasses because he doesn't want his photo taken in those glasses. And so he can't see. And Cynthia can't see. So clinging to each other, they walk into the ballroom. This huge room jumps to their feet and applauds, and he is just in a cold sweat. When they get to the podium, they separate them. John is going to sit to the right of the podium, if you're facing the podium, next to Lionel Bart. Cynthia is going to be sitting to the left of the podium. They can't even talk to each other. And as lunch progresses, they are hoping that Brian is going to come up and say, listen, I'm here, I've got it, you're covered, calm down. Mm-hmm. Bronson, who is seated next to Christina Foyles, the owner of Foyles Bookstores, the oldest and largest bookstore in England, will not get out of his seat because he doesn't think that's the polite thing to do. So John, the longer the luncheon goes on, the more John is convinced that if Brian were there, he would come up. And Brian is convinced that John will stand up and say, and now my manager, Brian Epstein, will speak for me. So there's no communication. John doesn't think Brian's there. Brian thinks John will announce him. So when the master of ceremonies, and you can watch a film, this footage is on YouTube, the master of ceremonies stands up and says, ladies and gentlemen, the man of the hour, Mr. John Lennon. You can see the fear on John's face.
Oh no.
Brian's not there, as far as he knows.
Mm-hmm.
He stands up. He is coward. He's hiding behind the microphone. He's bent double at the waist. He makes the sign of the cross and says, you've got a lucky face, which in Liverpool, he says, thank you, you've got a lucky face. In Liverpool, when you say, you've got a lucky face, that is the term that street beggars use when you toss a coin to them. When you give them something nice, but something they don't deserve, something they haven't earned, mm-hmm. that's what they say. You've got a lucky face. And that's how John feels. I don't deserve this. I didn't earn this. You're giving it to me because I'm a Beatle, but I don't feel like I deserve this. I'm humbled. And he sits down and they begin to boo him.
Wow.
So Brian says, please excuse me, please excuse me. He jumps to his feet. He makes his way to the front of the room and asks the master of ceremonies if he can take the stage. And he begins to deliver his speech. Against my better judgment, John Lennon took this job of becoming an author on. I told him that he was busy enough being a Beatle, writing songs, recording songs, touring the world, and selling hit records all over the globe. But he was determined to be a writer. Without my permission and without my blessing, he did this on his own without any help from me. And I am so proud of him. And then the room springs to its feet. So, you know, did John know? Yes, he knew. Was he afraid when the day before, when an interviewer says to him on radio, they've got the tape, John, are you going to deliver the speech? He says, I daren't. I daren't. So he full well knew he couldn't do it. And there was this huge mix up. And it really ended in a very beautiful way because John is extremely indebted to Brian to coming back for him. And he determines that whatever happens that afternoon at the book signing, whatever happens, he's going to behave himself and be nice and be gracious because he owes it to Brian. So when a woman walks up, shoves 12 copies of his book in his face and says, you will sign every one of these and I will tell you what to sign. He doesn't say a word. He just does it. So it's really the real story to me is always more touching than the story that we don't understand. When you get to the root of these stories, there's beauty hiding there.
Well, and it also goes to the power of Brian Epstein's relationship too with John, which you've alluded to before and talked about. And there was a certain mutual love. And in that case, Brian helped sort of save the day a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, there's only really 4 years, about 4.5 years apart in age, but it's a relationship where not only are they very close friends, but in many aspects, Brian is a father to him. And that's the father that he always wanted, the father that would stand up and say, and I'm proud of him. Wow. Yeah, I'm very proud of him. So it's one of the better moments of 1964 for John, and it could have been one of the worst.
Yeah, that's a great story. And again, I'm sure there are lots of stories for this year, and I'm just looking right now at the tour itinerary for the summer 1964 U.S. and Canada tour, and I think I counted 26 performances from August 19th to September 20th, somewhere around that, and it's almost every single night, and just unbelievable, and all around the whole country. So what have you found, or what are some interesting things you've noticed, apart just from the continuing with your thesis about the Beatles never sleeping and working constantly?
In a lot of those cities, you know, they're playing twice. They're
right.
playing two concerts,
right.
you know?
Yeah. And there are some great stories on that tour. I've done a lot of research. I live in Kansas City, so the Kansas City stop has been written about a lot and discussed because it was a special add-on. But some of the other ones are interesting, too. So what have you discovered and some interesting stories or things that you learned about that summer tour?
Well, I lived in Kansas City for 6 years, too, so
yeah,
I love Kansas City. And I cannot wait for that chapter. In fact, I have 2 tickets from the Kansas City concert, and I cannot wait. That's coming up in just a few days. I'm really, really looking forward to it. But the story that I did not know before doing the research on this book is how things changed about mid-tour. When the Beatles play Indianapolis, it's probably the last or close to the last happy night of the tour. In Indianapolis, they play 2 concerts. One indoors, and then they have to move all of their equipment because they've already slated a gig for that evening in the indoor venue, and they have to move them out to the racetrack where they're going to do the evening show. Now, these Midwestern kids are extremely well behaved. They scream, but in between songs. During the songs, they listen. They sing along. You, when you listen to the bootleg tapes from Indiana, you can hear them singing along.
Oh.
The Beatles can hear themselves. It's an unusually cool night for late August, early September. They're under the stars. They hear thousands and thousands of teenagers singing their songs. They don't feel well. They're getting sick. It's mid-tour, and they're starting to really become tired.
Yeah.
But this moment buoys them up and gives them the feeling that the tour is all worth it. And then it happens. They land in Milwaukee. They land far from where they're supposed to be landing because the Milwaukee police have decided they're not going to have the destruction that's happened in other cities. They're not going to have those kids tearing the airport apart. So they make the plan, land far away from the fans, and they refuse to let the Beatles drive by the fans the way they always do and roll the windows down and wave. No, sir, you're going straight to the hotel. So the Beatles protest it, Brian protests it, Derek Taylor protests it, and that's the way it is. They're going to the hotel. Well, the press jumps on the Beatles and says that they broke the hearts of those kids.
Snubbing the fans. And
It's horrible. It's horrible. They do a television special. They do a news special. They have all the crying kids and the mothers holding the tickets and saying, we made these boys and we can prank them. Well, that's the turning point on the tour from Milwaukee on. And Beatle Bob Berry, who is the DJ that is going to MC their concert, tries his best to change things and to explain that the Beatles had nothing to do with it. The Beatles try to explain they had nothing to do with it and no one will listen to them. And from that moment on, the tour becomes a battle with the press. The press begins to dislike them. They go after them. They stand up and say horrible things to them. And the Beatles can't get out of that downward spiral no matter what they do. In Milwaukee, John is really sick now. He hadn't felt well in Indianapolis, but he has a sore throat. And when he goes to Derek and says, you know, I don't think I can make the press conference, Derek goes, oh, yeah, that's fine. That's fine. Stay in your room. You totally know why. It has nothing to do with his sore throat.
No,
he doesn't want to unleash John on those reporters because they're all mad. Well, Paul, go back and look at that press conference. Paul, who is usually so gracious and so PR conscious, lights into them. He's so mad. We didn't have anything to do with this. It was the police. It wasn't our manager. Well, we heard that your manager said that this is what was going to happen. And he says, no, our manager had nothing to do with this. It's your police. And it becomes a battle. George is mad. Ringo even shouts at them. From then on, it becomes the press versus the Beatles. They have priests stand up and say things like, why do you hate your parents? What are you rebelling against? Do you think that the Russians are right, that you're dangerous and that you shouldn't be allowed to perform? Psychologists say, and they from then on, it's a battle with the press. And that is the pivotal night that changes everything for the Beatles. So, of course, by the time they get to Jacksonville, they're in full-out war. When that renegade crew is trying to tape the show, the police refuse to stop the renegade crew. And Derek Taylor has to go on stage and make his Nuremberg speech about, do you want the Beatles? Well, they're standing backstage waiting to come on. They won't perform until you get that video crew out of here. And he has to get the fans whipped up because the police and the press have turned against them. I mean, it was shocking to me to see the change from that one incident.
How do you even find that information, or were you looking at newspapers, looking at footage and reading those interviews, things like that? Is that you go to the primaries?
So many sources. I mean, absolutely. I could not have done this book without Beatles 64, which was written by AJS Rayl, R-A-Y-L. She used Kurt Gunther, who was the photographer on that 1964 tour, as her primary source. And of course, the incredible work by Chuck Gunderson, Some Fun Tonight, which is the backstage story of the Beatles tours in America, not just 64, but all of the Beatles tours in North America. And then speaking firsthand with Ivor Davis and Larry Kane and all of the DJs, like I had a long interview with Beatle Bob Berry about what happened and how he tried to solve the problem in Milwaukee, and went over the next morning at 10 o'clock and did a one-on-one interview with them to dispel these rumors that the Beatles were jerks, and
yeah,
was going to show what nice guys they were. But once you get on the bad side of the press, it's very
difficult.
It's
over, yeah.
And it was really over at that point. And then you start reading, you go to the Beatles interview sites and you start reading the interviews after that. They can't catch a break. Mm. They can make them laugh every once in a while, but the glamour days are over. Mm. And it's sad because they really sincerely had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it made the rest of that tour very, very difficult.
In the midst of having to go on night after night in new cities and multiple times a day, it's just a tremendous amount of pressure on those guys to deal with it, as well as the other big event of 64 was Hard Day's Night, filming the movie, which you've already talked about a little bit. You know, so can you give us a little bit of information on when the main recording or filming took place, and then when it actually came out, and kind of it was seen as a very positive thing, I think. The whole experience seemed very positive.
Yeah, and I found out so many things about that I didn't know, for example. But let me say, it started on the 2nd of March, and they film into the 26th of April, and that is every single day, getting up at 5:30 and working until sometimes 5 o'clock. That would be an early night. Sometimes they pushed it to 7, and then doing all of those extra events afterward. The only breaks that they ever got, one day at lunch, they went to the Dorchester Hotel to accept the Variety Club Award for the Entertainers of the Year for 1963. So that day they actually got to go to lunch and sit down and have lunch. But you're accepting an award, so you're nervous.
You're still on.
Ed Sullivan flies over one day to do an interview with them, and so they have a little break there. David Frost does an interview with them. But in any spare moment, there are interviewers waiting to talk to them. It's not like they're relaxing and hanging around. They're working. And then in the evening, they're doing those radio shows and those television shows. And the idea, Alan Owen's idea, was to give each of the Beatles a sketch. So we know about George's sketch with "We Turn Down the Sound and Say Rude Things."
Yep.
We know about John's sketch in the hallway, "She looks more like him than I do."
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Ringo's very large sketch.
Yeah.
Well, Paul too had a sketch. But the thing that you wouldn't expect, you would expect Paul to be the best of all of the actors, because he's the one that can always smooth over the problems, make things right. When they hit those ladies stopped at a stop sign on their Johnny Gentle Scotland tour, who do they send to apologize?
Paul.
Yes, it's always Paul. He always makes things right. But oh my goodness, he can't act.
That is so funny, because Chris and I, we've talked about that before. We were talking about the movie Help. And I remember Chris saying exactly that. Like, he said, Paul is the worst actor of the four by far.
And so, oh yeah. He's not good. And so they record his segment, and they have to cut it from the movie.
It was so bad.
Yeah, it's just so bad that they can't use it. And you can imagine how that hurt his feelings.
Oh, yeah.
But, no, he can't help looking at the camera when he's not supposed to.
He can't. He's mugging all the time.
Yeah, and they just can't use it. So, you know, it is an experience that gave them a very healthy respect for actors.
Mm-hmm.
And not bragging, I always take personal pride in anything that John does, but he's the best. He is,
yeah,
without a doubt, the natural actor. They let him run with impromptu lines, whatever he wants to say. They just let him talk. They roll it into the script. But as he points out in one of his many interviews, but by the time that I'd said it 12 and 15 times in takes, it wasn't impromptu any longer. You know, it loses its freshness when they say, oh, that was great, take two, say it again. It's better the first time. But he definitely is given full rein to say what he wants to say. and he definitely shines. Everybody, Richard Lester, Alan Owen, they all say John is a natural, and had we known that, with him the star of the show. Well, thank goodness they didn't, because Ringo is the perfect person to be the star of both of the films. And but you know, John is quite good, and George is good. I love his
scene. Oh, it's a great scene. Yeah, with the he gives us grotty and
and the new direction.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. The clothes and all that. Yeah. So, but it was seen, very positively, and gave them like a very big platform as well to get more exposure. And I remember reading a review once, and they said, "Oh, the movie's just a hour and a half long music promotional video for their songs." But I don't think that's totally true. I think there was more to it than that. It wouldn't have survived as well.
Yeah, you don't get two Academy Awards for just having a promotional video. And they were adamant about not doing a movie in which you burst into song nonsensically. they said it's got to make sense. We don't want to do a show like that. And so they really work it into the script in a logical sequence of events. And the Beatles don't feel that way about Help. They feel that many times the singing is just there and shouldn't be. But definitely in A Hard Day's Night, it's done quite poetically and genuinely. It also gives people a glimpse of who they were in caricature. I mean, Paul becomes the cute Beatle. John becomes the learned literary Beatle. Ringo becomes the sad-eyed little drummer that your heart goes out to. Mm-hmm. And George becomes not only a bit of a flirt, but very mystical and physical. And so you get a caricature of their nature. You learn a bit of their language, though some of it is exaggerated. You were introduced to them. I remember going to see it with my father, and I can just imagine what he thought. But when the show ended, he turned to me and said, because in the summer of 1964, you could do this. Do you want to sit through it again?
Oh, and how nice.
I said, oh, yes, I absolutely. He said, all right. So he sat through it twice.
Wow, good on your father for that.
Yeah. Really, really sweet thing to do. So, it just gave these fans who had seen the photos and heard the music a glimpse of who these people really were. And I think that was extremely important. Good on Brian for insisting on it.
Well, so we've talked about the two big event, or at least, I mean, a couple. There's so many things, but certainly the tours and the movie. Where does your book end? And kind of give us a preview of what's to come right after that.
It ends when it begins to dawn on John, Paul, George, and Ringo that 1965, which they had hoped would be less hectic than 1964, is going to be a replay of 64. They're going to do another movie, just as they did in the spring of 64. John's going to write another book. He's been working on it all through 64, and he's going to be under the same pressure not only to produce the book, but to go on additional interviews on top of what the Beatles are going to have to do to promote the book. Same thing he did in the spring of 64. They are going to be expected to produce two LPs as per contract. Mm-hmm. They are going to go back on North American tour. Everything that they did in 64, guess what? It's coming your way again in 1965. And they begin to worry that all those questions that people have been asking them about, what will you do when this ends, that maybe it's not going to end. Mm. Maybe they're going to be on this treadmill of repeating sort of Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
The same actions over and over and over. And I think at the end of 64, as they begin to step into 1965, they begin to worry that they're going to have to speak out and say, we can't live under this kind of stress much longer. We'll do it a little bit longer, but we were doing it because we thought there would be a plateau we would reach when this wouldn't have to be this way. And obviously it's not. Yeah. You're going to keep us on this treadmill. And it is, Ringo's been in hospital with tonsillitis in the beginning of June when Jimmy Nicol goes on the world tour. Then in December, all through the North American tour, his throat is sore and he's tired and he's worn out and he's sick. December of 64, he's sick again. They're beginning to age very rapidly. I mean, these do not even look like young 23-year-olds.
No.
These are very mature men, and they begin to realize they're going to have to speak out and defend themselves.
Hmm. That's really an interesting point, because when I teach my Beatles class, I show them pictures from that early, right from Ed Sullivan, or even right before that, and then you look at them just a couple of years later, and then you look at them during Let It Be, and it's hard to believe that they're still in their 20s, and that John had just, you know, was going to turn 30 in 1970. I mean, it's just amazing how much they aged, that stress and the constant going, and it really just never let up.
Yeah, it is incredible. And people will say, oh, it's the drugs.
No.
As much as I'm not a proponent of drugs, I think that's really what saved them, because mm-hmm. The pressure, there is never a moment when that waiting room in their hotel wasn't filled with people waiting to talk to them.
Yeah.
You know, there's no moment when you can feel as if you can relax. George said in 1964, we packed a week into every day.
Mm-hmm.
That's so true. They did.
Yeah,
a week.
Oh, just look at that schedule. I mean, the touring is just constant.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And what other people want from you on the side, Brian says, no celebrities are to be brought backstage for handshakes and autographs. No celebrities. But Derek can't do that, because when Liberace wants to come back to meet them, what are you going to say?
Of course.
The man was box office.
Yeah.
When Shirley Temple Black wants to come back and meet them with her children, what are you going to say? You come across looking horrible if you say no. And so every moment somebody wants something from them, and after a year of it and they think that it's going to go away and it's going to get better, 65 only gets worse.
Mm-hmm.
So the prospect, when that year ends and they hear what's planned for them in the year to come, is a real eye-opener.
Well, we'll have to wait to see and read all about it, because right now your book release date is scheduled for March 5th of next year. And so hopefully that will get everybody inspired, and we'll be waiting. And you can go to your website, which is, tell us about your website, where we can find this information.
Well, we have a brand new website. I'm so excited. I always loved my old website. I thought it was kind of fun. But when a very classy New Orleans publicist web designer looked at it and called it my Cracker Barrel website.
Time for a change.
Yeah, I thought maybe I might need to change some things up. So we have a new sleek website, and it is johnlennonseries.com. You can sign up for the newsletter there. I do a monthly blog. In fact, I'm getting ready to write one in the next week about all of the quotes that people accuse John of saying that he never said. Any negative quote that was ever attributed to the Beatles, John said it.
Always.
And he said almost none of them, including Ringo's not the best drummer in Liverpool. He isn't even the best drummer in the Beatles. John did not say that.
Yet that you see that in every book. They always talk about that. Yeah.
So, you know, I'm going to clear up some of those rumors, and we're going to talk about the fact that there are just some people who can't say anything right. Whatever they say, people don't like it. And John was one of those people, so it'll be interesting. But johnlennonseries.com, I'd love to have people join me there.
Great. That's excellent. And if you're longtime listeners to the podcast know, and that Jude is also quite a speaker, and she just finished... you were organizing the Beatles at the Ridge Conference in Arkansas. Is that right? You had a very big role in that.
Yes, I'm the director for the symposium. This was our fifth year, and we just announced last night our cast for 2018. Vivek Tiwari, who did the fifth Beatle,
yes,
New York Times best-selling book on Brian Epstein, is going to be there next year. His book is being made into a multi-night event for television. that you'll be there, hopefully, to show that to the crowds that come to Beatles at the Ridge in Northern Arkansas. And Dave Bedford from Liverpool is going to be there to talk about his new book, In Search of the Fourth Beatle, about all of the people who drummed for the Beatles, as well as showing his film, Looking for Lennon. I went into that film thinking, oh, no, I'm not going to like this. No. This is going to be full of inconsistencies and myths. And
same old stories.
And yeah, it's going to put me in a bad stead because I'm going to have to be nice and I don't want to. This is not going to be good. And the first thing they did was admit that John was Irish, which almost no one does. And gave credit to his Irish heritage. And I thought, okay, this is good. Then they begin to tell the story of how at 4 and a half, Freddie and Julia are in this squabble about who's going to get John and how Pop Stanley intervenes, which almost no one knows. And I went, oh, wow. And by the time it was over, I was leaping to my feet to give Bedford a standing ovation. And I immediately walked over and said, I will move heaven and earth to get you to show this film at Beatles at the Ridge. We hold this festival every year on the day that the Beatles flew into Walnut Ridge, Arkansas, met Reed Pigman, and got into Reed's little private plane, which was lit, as we all know, by a flashlight that he's holding out the window, to fly to the Ozarks for a few days of rest and relaxation. Walnut Ridge, like so many towns in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains and the Ozarks, those towns are struggling in America today, and it was dying. All the shops were being boarded up, and the town mothers and fathers got together and said, what in the world can we do to save our town? What, if anything, do we have that will keep us from going under? And someone said, well, Beatles landed here for a few hours in 1964, and they said, that's it.
Yeah.
Retool this town. All the streets are Beatles named, Beatles bookshops, Beatles gift shops. There's one called Imagine, great Beatles gift shop. They had a man come in and create a guitar that is so large, it's a welded guitar, that it can be seen from outer space.
Wow.
It's unbelievable. They recreated the Beatles crossing Abbey Road. An artist created these. They have a cafe, a Beatles coffee shop called The Dark Side. There's so many Beatles things in that town. And then in about 2011, their director, Charles Knapp, came to me and said, would you start a Beatles symposium at this festival? I said, well, I can't do it this year. I'm moving, but maybe next year. And we started in 2012 with only Lena Stagg and myself as the two speakers. And now we have next year 8 authors.
Wow.
One teen musician who will be performing the entire White Album, incredible, Cameron Hicks. We have Vivek Tiwari and Dave Bedford, two outstanding artists, and filmmaker David Bedford. So, I mean, this is going to be a red lettuce year, as John would say, and it has saved that town. They just announced at Beatles at the Ridge that a $60 million disaster preparedness training center is moving to Walnut Ridge. And why?
Interesting. Oh.
Because of the Beatles Festival. So. Huh.
So even when you don't expect the Beatles to have an impact in Arkansas, there it is. They're doing good even there.
They've changed the lives of those people. And last night when we announced the lineup, I know we get all choked up here, but Mayor Snap wrote me a note and said, I want you to know that the Beatles have changed our town. They have saved our town. And we, by now, this town would have folded. We would have all been gone. But because of the Beatles, we are growing. And every day, someone is calling me to build something new in this town.
Wow.
Thank you. So.
Oh, that's great. It's nice to hear those sorts of things in these days. So I'm glad that's working out so well, and sounds like quite a lineup for next year. So I really need to get down there. I'm not that far away, so I should check it out for sure.
I would love it. I wish you would come and do a live show.
Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah,
talk to some of these people and record your show, because you would fall in love with them, and they would fall in love with you. You become part of the family.
Oh, well, that's a great idea. Let's see if we can make that happen.
Yay!
Yeah. So, are there any other upcoming events that you like to share with us?
Well, of course, my most exciting one is that the book release party for Should Have Known Better, Volume 4, is going to be at the Fest for Beatles fans. And you and I talked a little bit before the show about the fact that even though Mark and Carol Lapidos are my same age or close to, I never ask people's ages. I don't want to get smacked. But they are my parents. I mean, they have sort of adopted me into the Lapidos family. And I absolutely love them. And they wrote to me and said, if you will just finish the book, we will give you your book release party at the Fest for Beatles fans in New Jersey in March. So that's why it's slated for March. And Richard Langham, who was second engineer at EMI when the Beatles recorded From Me to You and the Please Please Me LP, and who always helps me with my recording sessions information, is coming that weekend to sit with me at the table and sign the books along with me. So,
excellent. Wow.
It's going to be a wonderful weekend, and I just can't wait.
Yeah. Well, it's got to get through the winter here, and then we'll see you in March. Oh, very exciting. Look forward to that for sure. And in the meantime, you can, as Jude said, go check out her work at her website at johnlennonseriesalloneword.com. And we will definitely look forward to the new book, which is called Should Have Known Better, coming out next year. So
I cannot wait. Thank you so much for having me on the show. It really, like I said, it was the one thing I wanted to do to celebrate John's birthday, and it is always such a joy being with you, Dave.
Well, thank you, Jude. I really appreciate it, and it's we'll definitely do this again closer to your book coming out, so we can check in and see how things are going. So in the meantime, we always have a closing song too, and this time you picked a late song from John. You picked I'm Losing You from Double Fantasy. So what? That's usually when I think of that song, I think of, well, the couple versions of it. I guess there was the Cheap Trick version, as well as the one that actually made it on the album. But I think of it as a Yoko related, like just I'm losing you, you're slipping away kind of song. How do you see I'm Losing You?
Yeah, it's definitely about that stormy period in their marriage when things were not going well. And, you know, he's like, yo, what do you want me to do? You know, you tell me one thing and then you do another, and you want me to feel guilty for things I can't solve anymore. It's full of anger. It's full of hostility. And yet it still has that age old thing to it. It's the same story John's been telling forever. I loved someone desperately and she wanted to leave me. And even though I feel like it's my fault, because from day one, that little boy, when he realized that his mother, who had left him with Aunt Mimi, had other children, she had two girls, Jackie and Julia, and he begins to reason, oh, it's not kids she doesn't want, it's me.
It's me, ooh.
Yeah, he begins to feel guilty. I'm sorry, I'll be a good boy. How many times does he say that in his songs?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I apologize, just give me another chance. And it's that same little boy singing this song now to this woman whom he calls mother, who is older than he is, who is an artistic bohemian woman, who has the long hair and the seashell eyes. The story repeats itself. So it's a very powerful song.
Yes, and not only the lyrics, but certainly the music really is gripping too. And that just at the beginning when he gives the ow kind of sound, it's this really visceral kind of song.
Yeah, one of his best ever.
Yes,
ever.
Absolutely. So, well, thanks again one more time to Jude, and we will be back in touch soon, and we'll go out listening to I'm Losing You.